Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and last week we talked to Martin Popoff about the first Iron Maiden album, and for this episode, episode two in my series on Iron Maiden, I'm joined by frequent guest, Fistful of Dave, to talk about the second Iron Maiden album, Killers. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Excited.
Yeah. Is this your favorite Maiden album?
No, actually, the first record probably is my favorite, but this would be definitely my second favorite. Although going back and listening to it, kind of has reinvigorated my interest in the record, and kind of like, oh yeah, this is kind of better than I, you know, kind of had put it in my mind, where it's like, oh yeah, the first record is the best, and I still think it's better for certain reasons, but I don't think this is as far behind as I wanted to make myself think.
Yeah, well, this is my favorite, and yeah, I was listening to it yesterday too, and I mean, obviously, I've been listening to this record so long since I was a kid that, you know, you're not really objective about it anymore. But thinking about it when I was listening to it and the kind of record it is, it's so different, especially from what was going to come after it. I think Iron Maiden with Deano, especially Killers, and Iron Maiden after are two different bands, pretty much, in a lot of ways.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, the vocals, I mean, obviously, it's so different on how they are. I think, for me, the bigger split comes when Clive Burr leaves. Because I did the thing where I listened to Killers, and then I did the first four, and then I listened to Number of the Beast, and I'm like, musically, it's not hugely different. But vocally, and maybe arrangement-wise a bit because of the vocals and a little less choppiness maybe on the arrangements on Number of the Beast. But they're fairly similar. But when I get to Peace of Mind, it's like this sounds like – it's like the fully mature Maiden. I mean, Peace of Mind, I think, is like the template for Maiden everything after that has come. And I think what people think of Iron Maiden more than their sound, more than the first three. But Clive Burr seems to, he's got a different feel and kind of swing, like not as technical as I'm spacing on his
Nico,
name.
Yeah.
Nico.
Yeah, when he comes in on Peace of Mind, it is pretty noticeable.
That's what I always thought, you know, going from the two, and like I said, the vocals are just so, styles are so different. But musically, I think it's kind of the same, you know, kind of the same. This whole record, except for what is it, two songs, is all written during the same time as the first album is. It's like they had this whole bunch of songs, and the only new songs are Murders in the Rue Morgue and I think Prodigal Son that they wrote for this record. So it's kind of that first group of songs, and then they had to write a whole new set of songs. So that, you know, it's kind of, it accounts for the difference in Number of the Beast also.
Yeah, you know, I've seen it said that Prodigal Son was written for the record, but I also, in one of the books, either in the, I have the, there's the Killers book that's just about the first, the time period of the first three albums, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have the book Run to the Hills. In one of those, it said Prodigal Son was written in 78.
Oh, that could, well.
Yeah, but yeah, could. I've also seen it said that it was new, so I don't know.
I want to say it said in the book. I have the one with the Dance of Death cover that Mick Wall wrote, and the title's escaping.
Yeah, that's
me.
Run to the Hills. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think like you said, Peace of Mind is mature. Yeah, I think Killers is kind of the rambunctious teenager version of Maiden, and then yeah, Peace of Mind is when they're kind of growing up. But I think what's so different about Killers is it's all up tempo and just fucking fast, and more of just a rock and roll version of Maiden almost.
Yeah, I think I think the production is a huge. I mean, it's the first album's a lot looser sounding. This one is very a lot more precise of that, you know, the precision that you get of Maiden. So that's kind of the, I think, the difference between the two on the production. And you know, I know the band hates the production. I think the first record sounds fine for what it is. I'm not quite sure, you know, if it would have the same charm if it had that. I mean, I'm sure I'd love it because, you know, you can't really go back and rehear things with something different. But
yeah.
I went back and I was like, I was expecting the first record, listening them back to back, which I haven't done probably since you know, the '80s or whatever, that when those were like the three made, I had just the first three Maiden records or whatever, but, how similar musically they are, but the production just makes such a huge difference in like how I'm sure Birch was, you know, the precision of how they recorded the record is a lot more, it's tighter and a lot less kind of just kind of a, sounds like a, you know, the first album just sounds kind of like a live set almost. So.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. When I was talking to Martin, we were talking, I mean, I don't really have a problem with the production of the first album either. He was saying that, his only issue would be the bass sound or something, which I didn't really thought about. Yeah. But yeah, you say live, like it almost seems like they were going for a live feel. But then Martin was saying that doesn't seem like the kind of thing Maiden would do, is try to go for a live feel. He would think Steve Harris would want to be like, you know, a tinkerer in the studio with all his prog influences and stuff. So
yeah, and that, I think that comes out, and maybe that's part of their disappointment with the first, is that, you know, they didn't get to do it. And it was like, yeah, this is, you know, I looked up Will Malone and he's done such a ton of things that, but I don't think I have anything else that he did, or I'm unaware of it, but it's definitely a 70s kind of style production. Whereas Killers is that eight, you know, it's like the difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the older Priest, which is that real kind of,
right,
70s kind of, you know, warm, I guess, is, I can't, without lacking a better word than warm, but you know, it's a lot less high end. There's a lot less crispness to the thing. And that's, Killers is definitely bright, and the bass sits in a specific place where the bass is, everything is kind of mixed together on the first record.
Yeah. They recorded the first album in 13 days. And plus the band claimed that, you know, Will Malone didn't really do much, and they pretty much did it all with the engineer. So, mm-hmm. It was just a rush job, and I guess Will Malone didn't really help out a whole lot, according to the band. So, but I think it sounds fine. I mean, I think it's, yeah, I don't have much of a problem with it. Like, Prowler sounds awesome. So,
yeah. Well, and I think if you go back and listen to the other, you know, like the Soundhouse stuff or even the stuff on Metal for Mothers, it's way better.
Yeah,
performance-wise, sound-wise, than any of that stuff. I mean, it's exponentially better than that. So
yeah, that would be a great way to just hear how well done Killers is just to compare Wrathchild from Metal for Mothers to Wrathchild and Killers, and
yeah.
It's Wrathchild astronomical. And so
yeah, well, it sounds lazy on like, and it's just, you know, you're so. I didn't hear that till after. And I'm like, wow, this is so, you know, there's that weird guitar thing in it that's not in the on the Killers version, but it's just so kind of laid back. And I think that has to do with Clive Burr's not on that, I'm pretty sure, that it's he made a huge difference, I think, in the quality of how Maiden was when he entered the band, that he gave it a bit of a spark and a kind of a drive to the drums, because he's very, you know.
Yeah, and I think I also read that Dave Murray was the only guitar player playing on the Metal for Mothers tracks.
I was trying to figure that out, and that's what it seems to be the case.
But when that came out, Wrathchild must have sounded pretty damn cool at the time, you know? I mean, obviously they did it way better on Killers, but when Metal from Others first came out and people first heard Wrathchild, because it's pretty different from the other early Maiden stuff that had people had heard at the time, I think. I don't know.
You know, they went through so many members.
Yeah.
And, like, Murray and Harris, or Deano aren't back in until, like, late 78 or 79, aren't they?
Yeah, late 78 is Deano. Dennis Stratton and Clive Bird joined the band, like, the same month they signed the record deal. So, yeah,
right.
They were really in flux, you know, right up until the time they made the first album, pretty much.
Right, and that could be another thing with the first record. These guys are brand new to the band, and then we're going to record a record in 13 days. So I'm sure that has something to do with even if they had Birch producing the first record, like these guys are like brand new and they had been switching members, and that, you know, that could be a difference in the performance between the two, is they played on the road as a band for, you know, they toured their asses off. You know, the band kind of matured from there and got used to playing with each other. I mean, they didn't have a lot of time together.
So in between the first album and Killers, this really strange thing happens where Iron Maiden record this cover of a song by an Australian band, Skyhooks, which, you know, I've heard everything by Skyhooks and I don't really like them a whole lot. I would say Women in Uniform is the best Skyhooks song. I like the Skyhooks version, but the Iron Maiden doing the song just makes no sense. It's really strange.
The label brought it to them, from what I understand.
Yeah, or the publishing company, Zomba. Yeah, it was a top 10 hit in Australia. So they're like, hey, this is a hit there. Nobody knows it here. It's already proven to be a hit. Hello there, sailor. Hi, in my lane. Good morning, scuba. Welcome to the team.
in that Run of the Hills book, they talked about like how this was a it looked at as a major possible misstep, and are the band going to be able to get back on track after this? And I heard this after, but I've never really had a problem with the Women in Uniform. I think it's kind of the main version's kind of fun. I don't know. You don't seem to care for it too much.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't have a problem with it. I would never really listen to it, but it's just really odd that Steve Harris went along with it and that they did this song. Plus, the Skyhooks version has a kind of intricate arrangement, which Maiden just cut parts of it out. Just, you know, they right, just took yeah. out the weird stuff and just kind of, yeah. So they just edited the song. They didn't cover the song, the whole song.
Right.
They just kind of took parts out. So it's kind of just a simplified version of the song.
They said they wanted to make it heavier. That seemed to be the big problem, that it wasn't, you know, heavy metal enough or whatever the, you know, the thought on it was, but that was the point of how they did the song the way they did it, is they wanted to make it more heavy.
I guess really the sole purpose was to try to have a hit.
Yeah. Well, that's for sure. And the band said that would never happen again, I believe, after that was the quote from Steve Harris.
Yeah, no, I think Steve was very disenchanted with the whole experience and, yeah, you know, regrets it. But it's no big deal. But it is strange that it happened. And I remember the video is in the 12 Wasted Years VHS that I've.
Yeah, that yeah I have. It
is. And, yeah, and back then when I first saw that, I didn't even know what that song was. I had never heard it before.
Yeah, I thought it was a Maiden song.
Yeah, right. I didn't really know this story until later. Right. But yeah, it never really connected with me. I never really thought it was that great of a song. I definitely like the Skyhooks version more than the Maiden version. But
yeah, I've only heard it a couple times, and I don't remember what my reaction was about it. And
well, it's definitely not a heavy metal song.
Yeah, but, right. That I remember.
Yeah. Well, the other big thing that happens between the first two albums is that Dennis Stratton is out and Adrian Smith is in. And I guess basically they wanted Adrian Smith before Dennis Stratton, but he was trying to do his own band, Urchin.
Yeah, Urchin.
So he wanted to do his own thing and not be somebody else's sideman, which obviously is understandable. You know, I was reading one of their big problems with Dennis Stratton was that on the Kiss tour, he was just hanging out with the Kiss guys and not hanging out with Maiden. And I guess he was older and he wasn't really into the same kind of music as them. And they just didn't really connect with him on a personal level, I think.
Yeah, that seemed to be for sure that they weren't, that they didn't get along that way. And then, you know, Red Stuff, he was definitely into I want to say the Eagles is the one band for whatever that comes to mind that he was into that. And they weren't like, you know, they were all like Purple and he liked UFO, but he like that was the heaviest thing he liked or whatever was UFO. And he tended to go lighter. And yeah, they just didn't, it seemed to be, you know, they talked a lot about it musically, but it seemed definitely a personality issue that they really didn't get along. And
yeah,
you know, I think his strain, you know, they're like, oh, he was more interested in playing Strange World than, you know, Prowler or whichever one of the, you know, Phantom of the Opera, whichever they discussed songs. He was more into that kind of lighter, moody, atmospheric kind of music than the heavy stuff, which he says he denies. He's like, no, I'm into that. You know, I like all kinds of music, blah, blah, blah. But which leads me to believe it was more he didn't fit in with the rest of the guys.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. They wanted Adrian all along. And plus the fact that him and Dave Murray were longtime friends and they had already played together. Dave Murray had been in Urchin at some point. So obviously it must have been a very easy transition to, you know, bring Adrian in. He had already played with Dave. And, you know, so now the band was very tight, even though they sounded tight enough with Dennis Stratton, too. I mean, if like when I listen to Transylvania, you know, Dennis Stratton was no slouch. I mean, there's great guitar in that first record. There's no issues there. So, you know, he was good in the band.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So, but, you know, bringing Adrian in, that must have been a pretty easy transition.
And Maiden is all about Steve Harris's vision. And I think it playing wise and it is definitely, I think, was more towards what he was looking for. And, you know, the precision, progressive, heavy rock kind of metal kind of thing. So
yeah, pretty much, I guess most of the songs that they end up recording for Killers, they already had even before the first album. there's not a lot of, in the books, there's not a lot of information about the writing of the songs or the recording of the album.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't really know a lot of details. I mean, obviously, a huge change is bringing in Martin Birch, which I read he produced The Killers was sandwiched between Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules. So,
right. Well, and that, you know, there's the whole talk. There's the whole talking with him in that Run to the Hills book about, and I don't remember who brought it to him that said, hey, you should be into this. You brought him the Iron Maiden record. You should be into this band. And, oh, I would have done that if they would have offered it to me. And Maiden didn't think he would have done it because they were too small and that whole kind of story. Yeah. So I don't know if that's just legend building or what it is with that or how true that is. But
of course, he had done Burn and Rainbow Rising, which are, you know, two legendary records that I'm sure.
Steve Harris
was a huge fan of those.
Right. And he liked BOC and he had done the BOC record. And yeah, of course, you'd be like, yeah, that guy's great. I mean, and his records all sounded great. I mean, I don't think there's any denying. Even Michael Schenker's Salt Attack, I think by far is the best sounding record, whether you like it or not. But I think it's the best produced record out of any of the Michael Schenker records. So
yeah, that's my favorite because it's Graham Bonnet.
Well, it's my favorite too. I like Graham Bonnet. I think he was the best singer that they had. I just, the production and Bonnet on that is just, I think, takes it to a whole different level. But you know, you hear all that and it's like, yeah, of course this guy is going to be able to make a great sounding record and you know, has done things that are, you know, Rainbow and even Sabbath is fairly, as far as intricacies of how that is. And you know, you can hear all the instruments, which I'm sure part of Steve Harris's problem on that first record is the bass. Not that it's inaudible, it's not like in Justice for All, but it's definitely mixed, you know, sound wise it's mixed more with the other instruments, whereas, you know, you get the Killers and it's, there's the bass, it has a place where it sits. So what was your first Maiden record that you got?
The first one I heard was Peace of Mind.
Okay.
Because that's the one my uncle had. So
it always comes back to your uncle.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
So when did you get Killers? Did you just start buying back after you got Peace of Mind? Or?
Yeah, I don't even remember when I got it. I think I remember. I think I bought the first two at Record Head. You remember Record Head in Milwaukee?
It's still there.
Yeah, I bought the cassettes. I think I bought the first two at the same time there.
Yeah.
When I was like 12, 13, something like that.
Right.
And really not knowing much, but always really connected with the Paul Di'Anno albums. It seems like two different bands to me in a lot of ways. And
yeah, I would agree. And I mean, Killers is the first record that I got. And two reasons for me buying it. Obviously the cover. I mean, everything about the cover, the band logo, Killers, Eddie.
Yeah.
Like how could this possibly be bad? Is, you know, and I'm looking at the song titles. But then, in addition, this is when you start looking at things like, who produced this record? Because I started noticing things like that. I'm like, oh, Martin Birch, he did Sabbath. And I love the Sabbath records he did and the Rainbow records he did. So then I was like, oh, yeah, this has got to be good. So this is where I started. And then I was a fan. So I don't know if that, I mean, you're a fan of the Di'Anno stuff, but tends to be, it seems like a lot of the people that heard the Di'Anno stuff first, that tends to be their favorite. Because you couldn't escape, at least with friends of mine, there was no escaping Wrathchild and Killers. Like, people played the death out of those songs. It was like the, you know, the theme of the metalheads for that whole year of 81 or whatever. So.
Yeah, I mean, I love Peace of Mind, but there's just something about the Di'Anno albums that I just like more. And
yeah, there's a bit of more recklessness and the songs are faster and
yeah,
you know, there's that whole punk debate. Steve Harris says we hated punk. Paul Di'Anno now says I was into punk and yeah, I was into that, which I think is probably true just from the how he dressed, you know, the short hair and the leather and how his vocal style is a little, you know, rougher and probably has to do with physical things. That's how he could sing. But, you know, it's like you get like Running Free has that whole, it's kind of, you know, it's got the whole glam kind of, you know, it's like a glam heavy metal song, but, you know, not poppy, and you know what I mean, in that way. So
yeah, and there's nothing pretentious about the two Deano albums, which, you know, there's definitely moments that you could describe as pretentious after. there's just a lot of charm, and they're just fun too. They're fun.
Yeah, charm
records.
Charm is a great, and fun, and it's a lot of, you know, I go back and there's technical heavy metal I like, but when it gets down to it, and it usually doesn't matter what kind of metal it is. I don't care if it's thrash metal or death metal or whatever, but it comes down to, like, simplicity might be a little, but like easy to digest, simple, like this is put together in a way that it's thin and has an intensity and a charm and a kind of recklessness to it. And that, I think, right, those first two records definitely have. Even Number of the Beast, and with a little bit, which I think goes back to the Clive Burr's drumming, kind of gives it a, he has a feel that's just, gives a feel to the songs that is just different from Nico.
And interesting about Killers is that all of it's written by Steve Harris, except, I guess, the lyrics to Killers. Otherwise, it's all Steve Harris. Yeah, and it's all up-tempo, pretty much. And it's not, there aren't any long songs. So, yeah, it's just kind of a streamlined version of,
yeah, I'm looking. The longest song is Prodigal Son, which is 6 minutes, but mostly everything's four and under, besides Killers and Prodigal Son. So
yeah, Prodigal Son is the only thing that's like remotely a ballad on here, and it sounds more like a 70s rock song or something than anything, I think. It's definitely the oddball on the album, just as far as style.
Yeah.
The evolution of the Eddie character from the first album to the second album is so huge. And I think you could kind of look at that as kind of emblematic of the evolution in the band and the songs, maybe too, or maybe the production and just the way the album is presented.
That's definitely for sure. I would agree with that. Like this is a more streamlined, intense, kind of scary version of, you know, the first one is whatever, it's kind of creepy or whatever, but the Killers cover has a menace to it, because the first one was really kind of more crude, I guess. And then, that's great. That's a great observation. It's the representation is all the visible representation is aligned with the sonic representation.
And it's got to be their coolest album cover, right? I think it's my favorite.
Yeah, I like Number of the Beast for so long, just the whole concept of it, but yeah, it's great. I mean, there's, everything is about it, all the little details and the...
What did I read that Derek Riggs, the Number of the Beast painting was originally, he originally gave it to them for like the Twilight Zone single or something, and Steve was like, no, this is too good, we got to use this for a record cover.
I saw that too, and then they replaced it with the devil face falling apart and Eddie's head is behind it or whatever.
Yeah,
I read that also.
So from what I saw, it seems like when Killers came out, it got like bad reviews, which is crazy.
Yeah, that people were disappointed in it, that it, you know, and I guess sonically it's just a huge difference from the first record and from everything they had done before. I mean, my difference with it, like the first album, I mean, part of why I would say I like the first album, I think it's an easier listen front to back, and not that that's necessarily a good thing, but I think it is here. I think it works more together as an album, like start to finish. There's points in Killers where I'm just kind of like, this is kind of weird and kind of takes you out of the record. And, you know, I don't like the first records, like front to back, just like, okay, right. You know, now we're on to the next one. And whereas sometimes on Killers, we have one particular moment that we'll get to when we go through the song rundown. It's just like, it kind of stops. And I'm like, and I don't know if it's a sequencing or if it's just because of, you know, what it is. But I think there's a point for me that kind of stops the record. So that's kind of part of my issue with Killers as far as not liking as much as Iron Maiden. I mean, I love the record, but it definitely is a different, they didn't repeat themselves on like how the sequencing worked and how the album flowed and things like that. So
probably the main issues for me with the first record are there are a couple of songs that I just don't want to hear anymore because I'm just sick of them, and I don't know if I really liked them that much in the first place. Like Running Free, I can't listen to that song anymore. I'm just done with it. You know, just too much.
Sure. Yeah, you have that. I mean, it's that I have the same thing. I mean, I don't have the problem with Running Free myself, but like Paranoid by Black Sabbath. Like Paranoid and Iron Man. I never need to hear either of those yeah. songs ever again. And I love, like, Sabbath is probably my favorite band. And it's like, actually almost the whole record of Paranoid. It's like, okay, I got it. I'm just going to go listen to Masked Reality or Sabotage or whatever. But yeah, I can understand that.
But yeah, I mean, of course, the first album is great. And when you put it in perspective of the time period and what it was when it came out, I mean, yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
But Killers is just so much more fun for me. And yeah, there's no song on it that I'm sick of. I don't want to listen to Sanctuary anymore either. So there's a couple on the first album that, yeah. I guess before we get into the track by track, I guess the last thing to talk about is the exit of Paul Di'Anno, which I love the "You can't fire me, I quit." That's basically what the story is.
Well, I mean, reading about, he seemed to have issues with performance anxiety, like getting up in front of people, and I think as a matter of him wanting to feel wanted in the band more, maybe. I don't know if he was feeling like he was getting enough of the attention like that, but there's this story as how he wouldn't go on. They had to cancel all these German shows, substance abuse, you know, his vocals not being very good, him talking about, like, I just can't do it tonight right before they're going on, and Harris finally saying, well, screw it, we're going on anyways, and then him coming out and singing a few songs. So it seems like that tour was pretty painful in dealing with Di'Anno, which he, I think, agrees with on it. So,
yeah, one of his quotes is Paul said he was pretty much out to lunch on that tour. And yeah, booze, coke, speed, and plus he was having problems with losing his voice, which, yeah, like, you're, I don't know if it was anxiety related or if it was substance related or if it was just, you know, if he was sick or exhausted or I don't know. But yeah, it sounds like it was a very stressful tour. And here the band have momentum and Steve Harris could probably see this is going places and I'm not going to let this guy fuck it up. But, and, you know, the Steve Harris, Rod Smallwood version sounds a lot more believable to me than, you know, Paul trying to say he wanted to quit anyways.
Oh, yeah. I'd agree with that. I mean, there, Paul Di'Anno's story running through today is just, it's always seems to be some kind of excuses. And he still cancels shows and or he's singing in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw, like, oh, wow, dude, like, are you ever going to take care of yourself? I mean, and this, and we can, in the live thing, we can lead into to my story about seeing Maiden with Di'Anno in Milwaukee, Wisconsin at Summerfest that I got to go. And my parents, actually it was my mom, went. She was going somewhere and one of the neighbor kids was going to watch me and he wanted to go to see Maiden. And he's like, hey, I really want to go to this. You go, but you can't tell anybody. And I'm like, and I had just gotten the Killers record. I'm like, of course, why would I tell anybody? And got to see him and just, you know, not knowing at that time, like, he's practically out of the band and being able to see, you know, that and the excitement of that. It's all, like I've said to you, BJ, it's a blur of, like, the whole show. And I remember, and I was on one of his buddy's shoulders so I could see, and it was, you know, all exciting. But just that the opportunity that to see him, you know, you didn't think, you know, there's no, obviously, you always get into this with old bands. There was no internet at that time, but, you know, you didn't see any cracks that he was going to leave or any of the magazines that he was going to leave. But, that was one of the things that I hold on to, like, holy crap, I got to see Di'Anno Maiden. You know, you're never going to see it as much as Di'Anno, I think, wants that to happen again, that, hey, it would be great if I think a couple months ago they brought a Blaze and we should do a show with, you know, like a one-off show with Maiden. I don't see that ever happening. So it's just kind of one of those things I have that's like, holy shit, that's a crazy experience.
Yeah, it blows my mind. I mean, people listening who don't know what Summerfest is in Milwaukee, I mean, I grew up going to Summerfest, and the idea of Iron Maiden with Paul Di'Anno playing on one of the stages at Summerfest is completely insane. It's hard to even imagine for me. And if I had a time machine, that's one place I would love to go.
But yeah, it was definitely an experience. And being like my first real concert experience, it was just like it was just crazy. But yeah, Summerfest has been going on since, what, 1970?
Something like that, yeah.
You know, and there's various, you know, there's various moments in history, and it's the longest running consecutive festival and biggest and all this kind of stuff. But there's other things that happened. There's the Humble Pie Riot and
George Carlin got arrested there. My aunt and uncle were there.
George Carlin got arrested. And, it, you know, it's turned into what festivals are kind of now and then. But it's been going on. And there's been the Sly and the Family Stone where he was, like, super late. And there was a little mini riot kind of thing. So there's a history with the Summerfest in Milwaukee. So,
well, it goes on for, like, a week and a half. There's multiple stages. And, you know, when I was a teenager, we would just go all day and just see bands all day. My best stories of Summerfest are seeing like Rhino Bucket or Enough's Enough. That's kind of stuff I saw there.
Well, and then, you know, I'm a bit older than you, but like my recollection, you would go, and it's different than back then than how they run it now. But back then, if you got a touring package, usually would be on the stage. And I saw Yngwie with Talas opening, and then two Milwaukee bands, Blacklist and The Hunted, and you go, it was like four bands. It was amazing. So, you know, things like that happen. I think it's just as weird almost as seeing Yngwie on a big stage there in whatever it was, 1984 or whatnot. So,
yeah, we would just go and see whatever, you know, Dangerous Toys or just whoever was playing, you know. And back then, every band, they all came through summer. There were so many bands, you know, interesting bands to see.
Yeah.
And yeah, but seeing Iron Maiden there.
Yeah,
like I said, it doesn't even seem like it could have possibly even happened.
No, and I almost feel like I think I'm making this story up, but
I'm Dave from LPX, and I can, just for the people at home, I can see people all the way back to the double Ferris wheel. This is going to be one concert. Yeah. All right, we're all out here to have a really good time, and we're going to party. Please welcome on LPX and to Summerfest, killer recording artist, Iron Maiden.
Thank you. Good evening. How you doing? All right. I'll tell you if that, you know, this is being recorded, so let's make as much noise as we possibly can, all right? Here's a song from the Killers album, a song called Purgatory! Thinking of a little dream, place I have never seen, fast in this town before, swim right up to the floor. From now on, can't deny. Start dragging at my soul. Is it me? I just don't know. I'm trying to find the past. The shadows overcast. Start dragging at my head. The time is out in there. Oh, another time, another place. Oh, where another smile and another face. When you see me walking up beside you, get the feeling. We'll be right back.
We're Iron Maiden all the way to the East End of London. This is rock and roll. Song called Rothschild!
So I don't really think of the Ides of March as a separate thing. It's more just like the beginning of Wrathchild to me.
I wrote that down. Exactly.
Yeah.
It like almost seems part of it. I think it's like it's kind of this weird mood setting thing where it's this gives you a little bit of a mood, and then the contrast of Wrathchild coming in, I think is great. I think it works excellently, but I think it could have been one song. It could have just been the intro to you know, Wrathchild, and I don't know if the decisions because they wanted to possibly make Wrathchild as a single or what the deal was, but it does seem like one part of the same song as Wrathchild.
Yeah, it's just the intro of the album, and yeah, I mean, it just flows very well, and it's short. It's awesome, you know, it's great. And yeah, this version of Wrathchild, like we already talked about, it's so much better than the Metal from Others version. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's different from anything on the first album, don't you think?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a menace, and I don't know if this has to deal with, again, with the production and how the performances were brought out in this record, but it's definitely has a little more intensity to it than the first record. The first record sounds a little more laid back, and this has got a little bit of a bite to it, a little more attack to it, I think.
Yeah, I was thinking about how I was talking to Martin about Charlotte the Harlot. We both seem to be on kind of on the same page about that, where it's a cool song, but it's a stupid lyrics and just kind of the dumbness of it. You know, it could have, if they had taken it more seriously, because I love the chorus of the way the drums, just like the rhythm and the hammering of the chorus. And I think there's a lot of the same elements in Wrathchild. I was thinking Wrathchild is just like a more sophisticated, better done version of the kind of song that Charlotte the Harlot was. Or what I like about Charlotte the Harlot is just, it's Wrathchild is what I want Charlotte the Harlot to be, kind of.
Part of the difference, I think, between this record and the first is, I don't know, it seems to me there's a conscious effort to show the precision of the band. Because the amount on this whole record of stops and starts and arpeggiated kind of things going on is, we're talented, we can, you know, I think it's kind of like, hey, look how, we're really good players. And I don't know if that was the idea behind it, but it definitely seems like trying out to prove of how well they can play on this record. Or at least showcase their ability. It's kind of interesting, this record, like Wrathchild, is like, and then looking at the lyrics, and I never much thought about it, but you go into it and it's like about a son who's dead, you know, he's trying to find his dad and he's angry about it, seems to be what the whole thing is, and he's like wants to get back at his dad, and that, you know, he's an angry child because his dad left him or something. I thought that was kind of interesting. I never really looked into it. I kind of assumed the whole record was about murderers or...
Yeah, you know, I never really paid a lot of attention. I'm bad about that, about paying attention to what the lyrics mean.
The only reason I delved into it this time was like there's the whole idea, and then I kind of thought about it, that it's kind of a concept album about being wrongly accused, and then, you know, there's a whole Philip K. kind of dick thing, is did I do it or didn't I do it kind of thing running through the record, so... I thought I'd delve into the lyrics a little bit on that.
That's interesting. I think of it as kind of a concept album, yeah. Yeah, so then the second song, Murders in the Rue Morgue, I guess this is the most recently written song for the album. Not based on the Edgar Allan Poe story, like some people say. I mean, the only thing is that two women are dead. Otherwise, I don't think this song has anything to do with the Edgar Allan Poe story.
Right. Well, and this run, again, the theme I just talked about, like, I didn't do it, but it's kind of like I may have done it. I don't know if I did it, but I'm pretty sure I didn't do it kind of a thing going on in this song with lyrically. This, hands down, is my favorite Iron Maiden song ever.
Really?
Oh, I could listen to this song. I go nuts. Every time I hear it, I get excited. I love this song. I love everything about it. I love the stops. It's, you know, and I can see for some people that might be, because there's a lot of stop, start, and changes, and there's, you know, it's very kind of disjointed, which I think is kind of almost the theme on this record of like abrupt changes. But the pace, the vocal melody, the music, everything about it. I love this song.
I love it too. I love fast paced and yeah, great arrangement. It's just, it's not trying to be anything except what it is. It's just so seems so organic, and yeah, it's just, you know, spoiler alert, the murderer, I believe the killer in the Edgar Allan Poe story is a gorilla, I think, so when you see people say it's based on the Edgar Allan Poe story, it is not, but he just took the title. Steve Harris liked to do that kind of thing, just take a title or whatever and then kind of reimagine it. This is really just a rock and roll song, more than anything, don't you think?
I think along with Purgatory are possibly two of the most aggressive songs that in the whole catalog of Maiden stuff. It's just, I think there's kind of a level of speed, and you know, you're talking about how a lot of this record is up tempo that I don't think is, you know, Invaders or something like that, but I don't, the aggression and possibly what I like about the Deano stuff in this is that it's a little more aggressive instead of being progressive or, you know,
right,
that kind of a thing. So it's a lot more direct. It's very direct, even with the disjointedness. It's this, as you were saying, this is what we're doing, and it's this, here's what it is, and it is, that's what it is. This is, we're going to be intense and punch you in the face with it. So,
you know, that's great. It's aggressive versus progressive. That's exactly, yeah, that's what Killers is versus, you know, Number of the Beast, Peace of Mind. You start getting a lot more of the progressive stuff, and you had it a little bit on the first album,
like
Phantom of the Opera. But yeah, there's really none of it on this record. So, yeah, I remember when I was listening to the record yesterday, and you know, the first two songs are so amazing, and then when Another Life kicks in, and I was just thinking, it seems like there's really a singular vision going on with this record where, you know, Martin brought up about how Metallica, the idea with Metallica was just to take all the heavy parts and just only do the heaviest parts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was making me think about, I was thinking the same thing like when Pulp Fiction came out, where, you know, Quentin Tarantino was just the first person to have the idea of, I'm just going to fucking go nuts and put everything in this movie and just everything's going to be insane, you know? And that's kind of what Metallica did too. And I think that's kind of what Maiden did on this album, is they're just kind of all in on this certain version of kind of Iron Maiden heavy metal, but Steve Harris didn't continue to pursue this after this record. It seems like it was purposeful on the album to make a certain kind of record, and you know, it could have been very interesting to see what the third record would have been if they would have kept pursuing this kind of thing. Yeah, you were talking about how Another Life doesn't really have a chorus, but it's such an awesome song. And I think it's just like, it's a really confident kind of song. I mean, it's like I said, a singular vision. It's very purposeful. The songs are all in a similar vein.
Yeah.
And I think it was on purpose.
Yeah, I think this is one of those, what I was talking, I talked a little bit earlier about that this album gets just, there's like weird disjointed things that take you out of it. And this is where it starts for me. I think from Ides of March through Murders in Rue Morgue, I don't know if you can start off a record any better than that.
Yeah.
I always have this idea of 1-2 punch, and I always ignore intro songs of albums that have like the best first two songs, like starting a record. And this is one of them, I think, for sure. But then you get into Another Life, and it has that weird, spazzy kind of intro thing with the drums and the guitar, and it's just kind of like, what the hell is this? And then it has nothing to do with the rest of the song until yeah. the weird, disjointed, spazzy middle section part, which I think is that. And that's where I was talking about that kind of like, wait, what the hell is this? What are we doing here? And not that I don't like it. It's just kind of a jolt, I think, when in listening to it.
I think the end of side one here is probably the low point of the album for me. Well, I think side two is just fucking great all the way through.
For me, you could just throw Genghis Khan right the hell off this record.
Yeah.
It's pointless. Like, the second half is nice. I mean, it's got some nice guitar stuff. The first part is kind of this jerk-off gymnastic where it's talking about, look, we can play. We're really good. Like, yeah, I get it. But I'm like, this is the point in the record that I'm completely like, take this, you know, this, I'm taking it out of it. And then, you know, so what I did was like, you know what? I'm going to listen to this without this song in there. And I think it flows a lot better. And that's probably me, you know, confirmation bias with myself. But it just seems to stick out like it's an instrumental. What is it adding to the record? And I just, and not that it's bad. It's just I don't see the real point in that this is included. And then what was the song that wasn't on the original version that's on the U.S. version? Is it Twilight Zone?
Yeah.
Like, why not just, you know, this is where the sequencing thing is like, did they have time? Did they not think about it enough where it's like, oh, we're going to put on Genghis Khan and then the U.S. because this record, I'm guessing they didn't think it was long enough. We're going to throw another song. Oh, we got Twilight Zone, so we'll throw that one on. But I think it could have just been easily like, we can leave Genghis Khan off. We'll put Twilight Zone on and that would have been a better decision.
Well, shit, they could have stuck Invasion in here too, which is awesome on the right, Women in Uniform single.
Sure. Yeah. Or replace with Invasion. I mean, it's always hard, like, you know, when you're in the middle of it, how it works, like not thinking something works and, you know, hindsight is 2020 stuff. But
I agree. I like it. It's fine, but I would take it out. And I mean, if you compare it to Transylvania is so great.
Right.
And opening side two, it works really well. And it's just awesome. And this is nothing, not even close to as good as that. So.
Right.
And then Innocent Exile, which I think I read that Steve Harris wrote this song all the way back when he was in the band Smiler before he started Iron Maiden. And you could kind of tell it's good, but it's definitely the worst song on the album for me. So this, the end of side one here is, it's fine. It's not bad, but it's definitely the low point.
Yeah, Innocent, it seems like a typical Maiden, typical new wave of British heavy metal.
Yeah.
Type of song. Lyrically, it seems to be concept album, it seems to be an extension of Murders in the Rue Morgue. It deals with the same thing. The weird thing I think about the song, and this is just something you probably never say about Iron Maiden, it almost has a groove to it. Like that first part, you know what I'm talking about? It's kind of like, you know, if they could pull off a groove, this would be where it would be. But yeah, it's just kind of a typical Maiden song. It's all right. I don't mind. I mean, I don't skip it, but I don't mind it.
When you flip this record over for me, yeah, the holy shit. Side two of Killers for me is just amazing. I just love it. And of course, it starts out with the title track, which It's probably my least favorite song on side two, actually, even though it's incredible. The energy and just kind of the...
Yeah, this is probably out of the gate when I got it, my favorite song on the record. And I still love it. The whole harmonic descending riff thing, the regular part of the riff is great. You know, lyrically, it's again murdering and the impetus to kill somebody, things like that. I still love this song. This is another one that I don't think they really touch on the intensity and aggression as much anywhere after this album.
The music is awesome. The vibe, the production on the song. I think the one thing it lacks for me is like a really great hook, or the melody isn't quite as good as the rest of the songs on side two, which probably because Paul Di'Anno wrote it. So it's not quite as melodic or with the hooks, but yeah, this is a great song.
I don't think anybody does not know I walk in the subway and my eyes burn a hole. You walk in the subway, my eyes burn a hole in your back. I think that's ingrained in every metal person's brain.
Yeah.
But yeah. And again, this is another one of the part where they have this weird, there's a weird metal section in the middle part that it doesn't stand out as much as some of the other songs, but it's like they just all of a sudden go into this thing that has nothing to do with the rest of the song. So it's like this. Maybe this is the beginnings of the, like, I want to put this progressive thing on there. And then there's a solo part after this. So this is kind of distinct. Like, here's this weird kind of middle thing, which I think Metallica's copped off of early Maiden here. A lot of, you brought up Metallica with them before. But like, okay, we're just going to go into this wacky section.
Yeah.
And then ease back in the song. This definitely eases back in. Some of them are a little more abrupt than this. But then, you know, this is the middle part. And then there's the solo section after it. But, I'm just bringing it out. I don't have a problem with it, but I love this song. This is, you know, this is one of those, I think, all-time metal guy would. I'm not quite sure I've ever run into anyone that dislikes this song. That's unless they're not a Maiden fan at all. So
yeah, and it's a very like cinematic song. Like it's a little movie here, and that's really in part to the production and the arrangement and just the whole mood that the song sets too. It's really well done. Yeah. So on the US version of the album, the next song is Twilight Zone, which was released as a single in the UK, it was released as a single after the record came out.
Mm-hmm.
I love this song. The hook on the chorus is so great. Yeah, this is one of my favorites. I really love it.
Yeah, this is I like the song. Again, this is another one that struck me as if someone asked me what the new wave of British heavy metal sounded like, this is somewhere I would point them, because there's a lot of bands that definitely cop Maiden off those first two records. There's a great harmony guitar part in the midsection that I like a lot. Yeah, I dig the song. I don't have a whole lot to say about it. It's one of those ones I'm like, I don't have a lot to say about it, but I really enjoy it.
Yeah, for me, it's such a great chorus. And like you're saying, that, you know, new wave of British heavy metal bands, most of them, they don't have choruses this good. That's the problem.
Right. Well, and that's, I think, the difference, a lot of the difference with, you know, you go back and listen to a lot of the new wave of heavy metal stuff, and there'll be bands, and I know you'll confirm this, there's bands, and they'll have one song, and they are great. They'll make one song that's as good as anything, but the rest of it just... it isn't there. And there's so many new wave of British heavy metal bands that do that. The ones that stand out, I think, and last had, you know, there's definitely a hook, and there's a little, you know, they could write more than one good song, which obviously Maiden was capable of doing. So
yeah. So then Prodigal Son is, I don't see why the song couldn't have been produced and recorded more in line with the rest of the album. It still is kind of up-tempo. It's not a full-on ballad or anything, so it could have been... I don't know why they decided to use more acoustic guitars and make it, I don't know, give it this kind of a vibe. It could have been just more of a rock song.
I listened to this record, I don't know, 6 or 7 times in the last week, maybe more. And I kept coming back to this song and listening to it and like, wow, this is really different from the rest of the record. What is going on here? And the acoustic guitar, and I don't know how valid this is going to be, but somebody likes Rush a lot. Steve Harris, probably.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like Twilight Zone. And then, you know, and that it's weird. Then I go back and listen to the first record and Strange World sounds like something off of Caress of Steel to me. So, like, if you listen to Twilight Zone, it's really similar. There's the acoustic guitar. There's kind of big, like, the electric comes in for the chorus or pre-chorus parts. And that's kind of what I got out of it. I'm like, wow, there's, like, I want to do this. I like these Rush songs. I want to do something like that is kind of how it came off of me. And I really like this song, and I think it's, you know, I like it that it's kind of a, I mean, it's rather late in the album, but kind of a little palate cleanser of like, okay, we're gonna kind of give you a little something before we punch you in the head with Purgatory. You know, it's it just kind of gives you a little kind of a rest. But I really like this song, which has kind of come around from, I think it was my least favorite when I first got the record because all I wanted was Heavy, but
right.
I really like this one.
Yeah, I really like it too, but it sounds kind of weird in the context of the rest of the album.
Yeah, for sure.
Now we've come to my favorite song on the album. I said on the first episode, Prowler is probably my favorite Iron Maiden song, but this one is a close second. Purgatory. This is my kind of song. It's just fast and melodic. You know, when those two things come together just right, then that's my favorite kind of song.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Like, it's fast, it's aggressive, and then there's a great melody line. The pre-chorus and the chorus are fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
I love this song. I'm with you. This is probably my second favorite Maiden song, which is weird that I say the other one's my favorite record, but maybe by the end of this, I'll be saying Killers is my favorite, but love this song.
Brilliantly done, just everything about it. It's perfect. It's amazing. It's it's so great.
It's one of those things, like, it's you go into the song and then you have the verse part and it's like, yeah, this is great. And then you get the pre-chorus and the chorus that just take it to a whole nother level. Make this the last song. It'd be a hell of a way to go out, I think. Like, you know, like, because I like Drifter, but I think it diminishes Drifter by putting it before it. Because I just think it's so much better than Drifter.
Yeah.
That it would be a great way to end a record. And it's kind of on my... I always really love that... I'm going to go back to Metallica, as I always do. They always just put this raging song at the end. It was just a way to, like...
Yeah, Dyer's Eve.
Right. Yeah. We're going to end this record, and you know we're ending this record. And I think that's what Purgatory could have been. And I think it diminishes Drifter a little bit for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. And also, I mean, this is the only single from the album, because Twilight Zone was not on the original version of the album.
Right.
It was released, like, as an interim single. Yeah. So Purgatory was the only single released from Killers.
Yeah, Twilight Zone was just... Was it released before the record as the single?
I think it was after... The same with Sanctuary. Sanctuary was a single after the first album, and then they put it on the U.S. version, because both of these records came out like 6 months later or something in the U.S.
Right. Yeah, that was weird, because the first CD I bought of the first main record, Sanctuary, is not on it. That they just did the album version, which I thought was weird. Like, they just stick it on there. But...
And so you already mentioned the last song on the record, which I can't listen to this song and not think of our mutual friend Chris Standish, because he loves this song so much. And I always think of this story. I don't remember who the guys were that he was driving. He was driving, you know, his van, Rosie.
And
he had another band. I think he had a couple guys from another band in there with him, and he was playing the air drums while he was driving to this song, and those guys were freaking out because they thought he was going to crash.
I do remember
he has
this.
To play the insane air drums when he listens to this song.
Yeah, Chris was he was on the Goo Goo Dolls episode, right? Was he on the Soul Asylum?
Yeah, Soul Asylum. Yeah.
Yeah, he was. Chris is always was an interesting person to drive with, whether he was driving or he was a passenger in the vehicle.
Yeah,
there was always air drums and pointing and singing, and if there's piano in it, it would go on the dashboard, whether he was in the back seat or not.
And my favorite Chris driving story is when he had the van on cruise control and he climbed in the back to get his backpack while it was going down the interstate.
I was just going to say the same story.
Yeah.
That it's possibly the greatest thing. That the first off, it didn't crash, and that he just like, oh, it's on cruise control.
Yeah.
I'm going to walk in the back.
I got to get my backpack.
I thought it was a sweater, but it doesn't matter what
it
is. Yeah,
whatever it was. Yeah.
That is also one of my favorites.
But yeah, I think Drifter might be his favorite Maiden song.
It is.
Yeah, right.
And he also had talked about that. This is another one. He's like, talk about the middle section. I love the middle section. And I think the middle section of this is so weird and like out of place in this song. And I can understand why you'd be like, that's great. But it's so like all of a sudden we're going to do this little noodly thing, like this little crazy guitar thing. Like, what the hell is happening? And then, you know, Clive Burrow is like, when you get the crazy guitar thing going, he's got the crazy drum fills going in there, and everything's kind of like, you know, goes through this. It goes from like this regular kind of Maiden new wave of British heavy metal song, and then there's this weird, hectic, disjointed thing that happens. And
Yeah, well, there's a couple songs on this record that are almost more just rock and roll songs than heavy metal songs, you know?
I think you get a lot of that with British new wave of British heavy metal stuff.
Yeah, I wonder when exactly the song was written. I know I've seen reference to it being written before the first album, and I would just wager a guess that it was one of Steve Harris's earlier songs that he wrote, maybe.
Yeah.
I love it. I think it's great. It's just kind of a song that makes you smile, and you know, the sing it part at the end is awesome. Going to be a very different band after this record, which in some ways is kind of unfortunate from my point of view. But
yeah, I would agree. I mean, I like Bruce. I like Bruce fine. I like him too,
but you know,
I like Deano better. I mean, Bruce Dickinson obviously loves Ian Gillan. There's the whole like air raid siren kind of singing going on with him. And
yeah, well, people act like, oh, Paul Deano was an amateur and now finally they got the pro. It's like, fuck that.
Yeah, no, and I, you know, the idea of like he's that, you know, people are like, oh, now we have the vocalist to take them over the top. I think that has way more to do with Bruce's work ethic, because that's obviously his work ethic is impeccable as far as that goes. And he's somebody that worked hard. I think that's the difference between him and Deano. There's the possibility that they don't ever get as popular with Deano, but I think, you know, the operatic vocals are a little probably a harder sell than Deano's vocals to a general public, if you'd ask me. But I know, I'm probably biased.
No, I think you're right. I don't think there's any reason to say that Bruce Dickinson's vocals were any more like accessible to the mainstream audience than Deano's. And Deano's, I think, had a lot more character in his voice.
Yeah. And I think he had great melody lines. And I'm guessing. Melody lines. I don't think that was a problem either. And I think at worst, I think it would be hard to argue that that his melody lines are not as good as Bruce Dickinson's. But that's, I think, a lot of it. I find a lot of the first two albums are, for me, are definitely more immediate. And I spoke about how that's a lot of what I like about metal is like an intensity, immediacy, and then a hook. If you give me all of that, it's usually probably something I like. And that's, I think, what the first two records deliver.
Coming down, she would have left, so we heard my combo. Can't understand why they wanted to be. I never did.
And now to play us out.
What does that mean? To play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a song from what is called Bruce Dickinson's audition tape. Apparently this was done in late 1981, and I guess features Bruce giving it his all and trying to earn his spot in Iron Maiden. So let's hear Bruce give Wrathchild a go. Till next time.
Rock out! I come here to get you! Ooh, yeah.
I'll be back.